Thanks you.
Murray, you studied at Sydney University yourself.
I did, indeed. I did the Noble Arts degree right here in these hallowed halls and on that hallowed turf.
Yeah, so you've done a lot of sort of lounging around 101 on these lawns here.
Absolutely. I perfected the art of the horizontal read, you know, with the lying on your back with a book on your face.
But Murray, you have graduated from an arts degree, and you're not working at Macca's now, so well done. Are you actually studying a PhD in ancient history and ancient, particularly looking at Christian communities and their texts, and you work teaching in biblical studies at Presbyterian Theological College.
That's right.
Yeah, now today you're going to be speaking to us about Jesus and the good stuff. So thanks very much for joining us today. Look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Good. Thanks, Hugh. Well, first, let me congratulate the EU on hosting this fantastic event. And congratulate you on deciding to turn up. This is life. What a fantastic question. What a fantastic issue. Is there anything more important to talk about than what real life consists of? And I share with the EU the conviction that real life, satisfying life, substantial life, eternal life is found in Jesus. And so I want to spend just a few minutes this afternoon speaking to you about Jesus and the good stuff in life. Because life is full of random good stuff. I don't know if you've heard about Australia's largest ever lottery win. It was 8th of June 2008, four blokes in a cafe in Melbourne, on a whim, decided to fill out a scratchy, and the four of them split between them, let me get it right, $58 million, $14 million each in the pocket on the way home within a week. What a random windfall for those four blokes. And, you know, we don't often experience good stuff randomly at that kind of scale, but life is full of random good stuff. I met my wife because I decided to go on a whim on a bike ride 15 years ago. It was a charity bike ride, and she just happened to be there. We'd never met before, we wouldn't have met otherwise, and 12 years and three kids later, I often wonder what would have happened if that random windfall hadn't happened. And life is full of good stuff like that, random good stuff that seems to come out of nowhere. Whether it's a juicy steak on a Sunday afternoon, whether it's a beer with mates at the pub on Friday night, whether it's a friendship that develops out of randomly sitting next to somebody in a lecture in first year, whether it's the rush of a great movie or the challenge of a stimulating book or the beauty of a simple artwork, life is full of random good stuff. Don't get me wrong, there's plenty of ugly bits as well, and I want to talk about them a little bit in the next hour and what Jesus had to say about the ugly bits in life. And I don't want to trivialise the difficulties and the suffering and the hardship that many of us face in different ways. But for this moment, let me talk to you about what Jesus had to say about the random good stuff in life. Because I wonder if you've ever asked yourself the question, where does it come from? What's the source of this random good stuff that we all experience? I know some people want to say, well, it just is, Murray. Why are you looking for an explanation? Good stuff just is, because that's just the way the world is. It's just the world that we live in. But I think most of us have a sense that there's got to be more of a reason than that. Most of us have a sense that there's some kind of purpose in life, and that the good stuff in our lives fits into that purpose in some way. It comes from somewhere. And I think most of us experienced at some point or another the desire to say thank you to the someone or the something that makes the good stuff possible. Well, Jesus, I want to say, makes sense of the good stuff in life. Jesus spoke about the good stuff in life as a gift from God. Hear this. This is a quote from Jesus from Matthew's Gospel, one of the four biographies of Jesus that we have in the Christian Bible, where Jesus says this: God makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. God sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous, on those who do good and on those who do wrong. Jesus is speaking here about God as our creator. He's saying that the good things in life aren't just random. The good things in life are gifts. Gifts given to us by God. Gifts given indiscriminately to those who do good and those who do evil. Gifts given, wrapped up from our creator and given to us with no strings attached. Good gifts from a good God. Good gifts from the God who made us. And as soon as you start to understand that, you start to see that two common myths about Christianity haven't got a leg to stand on. First, there's a myth that the Christian God is distant and uninvolved and disinterested in the world. And some people have imagined God as like a watchmaker who created a watch and just kind of created the world and just kind of set it ticking, and that it continues under its own steam according to the laws of nature. Bette Midler famously sang, if you remember that far back, God is watching us. God is watching us. God is watching us from a distance. And I think she there captured what a lot of people think. But when you listen to Jesus, you see that the Christian God is not like that at all. God is intimately involved in the details of the world. Elsewhere, Jesus said, God clothes the grass of the field. God feeds the birds. God knows how many hairs are on your head. God is intimately involved in the world that he created. God is the one who keeps it ticking over every day. God is the one who gives us breath and heartbeat every morning. And if we've got a sense that we don't need God, then maybe it's because we've spent our whole lives like a fish in the ocean thinking that it doesn't need the water. We've become so used to the good stuff that God showers upon us so freely that we think we can live life without him. So the first myth, that God is distant and uninterested, just doesn't fit with what Jesus has to say about the God that he knew, the God that he spoke of as his father. The second myth is that Christian faith is somehow life-denying. And it's true that down through church history, some people have misunderstood this, right? There have been those who have thought Christian faith required of them to go out into the desert, that God would be found in denying themselves food and drink and sex. But if you listen to Jesus, you realize that that couldn't be further from the truth. God makes his sun rise on the good and the evil. God sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. According to Jesus, God is the source of all the good that we experience in life, whether it's food or drink or sex or friendships or relationships or music or art. Those are good gifts from God, wrapped up and given to us with no strings attached by the God who made us. Now, some of you, I'm sure, might be thinking, well, isn't this just a bit naive? Doesn't this reflect Jesus' first century mindset? Some of you might want to object, well, God doesn't make the sun rise. The sun is caused in our perception, that the rising of the sun is just our perception of what happens when the earth rotates around its axis. Some of you might want to say that God doesn't send the rain. The rain is the result of the complex processes of the water cycle, transpiration and perspiration and, you know, whatever, all those other aspirations that you learn about in Year 7 science. And so I need to clarify that when Jesus speaks about God as the creator, God who sends the rain and God who sends the rain and sends the sun, he's not denying that there are secondary causes. He's saying that it's God who works in and through the processes of the water cycle. It's God who works in and through the rotation of the earth on its axis to supply the things that we need, to provide the good things in life. It's God who, as the good creator, works in and through the processes that he set up. Because after all, this is his world and he made it. Which means there's another myth we need to do away with, which is that science has debunked Christianity. Understood properly, there's no competition between God and science. In fact, one of the most prominent Australian scientists, Professor Graham Clark, who won the 2004 Prime Minister's Award for Science, who studied and did his research at this very university, who invented the bionic ear, a major breakthrough for the hearing impaired, is on public record as saying that he thinks that God and science fit together like a hand in a glove. Why? Because this is God's world and God set it up in an ordered way. Science explores the processes of God's world. It answers the questions about the how and the what. But science can't answer all of our questions about life in the world. It can't tell me whether my wife loves me. It can't tell me how I should live. The God we know in Jesus answers those questions. The God we know in Jesus gives us answers to the questions of the why and the who and the what for. And Jesus says the good stuff in life are gifts from God, free gifts, wrapped up and given to us with no strings attached by the God who made us. Of course, there's a problem. Many of us don't experience full satisfaction from the good things in life. And so we spend our 20s in restlessness. We go from one relationship to another, one degree to another, one job to another. We travel the world trying to find ourselves. We try every experience on offer, trying to find satisfaction. And when the Rolling Stones sang in 1965, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," and it became the theme song of a generation, the reason that song has continued its popularity is because it captures something that is perpetual in our experience. That when we look for satisfaction in the good gifts of life, without the giver, we can't get no satisfaction. Jesus said that he came to bring life and life in its fullness. What he meant by that is he came to bring us life. He came to bring us the good things of life enjoyed in relationship with the God who gives them. You see, there's some gifts that you can enjoy on their own without the person who gave them to you. But there's other gifts that you've just got to enjoy with the person who gave them to you. When my first son was born, he's 6 years old now. When he was born, one of my good mates gave me a bottle of wine. Not just an ordinary bottle of wine, but a bottle of wine you can put down in the cellar for 5 years, for 10 years, for 20 years. And he said to me, mate, let's drink this together when your son starts school or when he graduates or at his 21st or whenever. But let's drink it together. And that was his way of saying, I want to stand with you and help you as you raise your son. Let's drink this wine together, this great wine at that point. And that's a kind of gift that, sure, I can drink it on my own. But if I don't drink it with the guy who gave it to me, I'm missing out. And that's what Jesus is saying when he says he came to give life and life to the full. The good stuff in life is a gift from God. And yet it's designed to be enjoyed with the God who made us. It's designed to be enjoyed with the giver, the one who gives us good stuff, who fills our lives with good things so that we might know him and enjoy life with him the way it was always meant to be lived. And so as I close, I just want to challenge you and encourage you. Are you enjoying the good stuff in life with the God who gives it? Or are you trying to enjoy the good stuff in life without any reference to him? Are you enjoying the good stuff of life, giving thanks to the God who gives it? Or are you trying to enjoy it on your own and missing out? Jesus tells us that the good stuff in life is a good gift from the God who made us, a good gift wrapped up and given to us with no strings attached by the God who created us. Good gifts given to us so that we can enjoy them with him.
Well, thank you, Murray. We're going to be taking some questions near the end of our hour. So if you've got questions, please do hang on to them. There's going to be a roving mic going around a little bit later. I'm now going to introduce Krish Kandiah, who's with us for this week all the way from the UK. You've been in Australia for about 48 hours now,
yeah.
Krish. Yep. And I've got had your first summer's day. What's the temperature back home in England at the moment?
Oh, all I know is it's raining and it's the middle of the summer.
Right. So you've been out sunbaking and...
Yeah, here I have, but not back home, sadly.
Superb. Sort of first reflections on being in Australia?
Oh, I'm loving Australia. I'm loving the weather, I'm loving the people, and the food is amazing.
Yeah. Our Scottish speaker who's been out for the last week went out on the weekend on a boat and he said, oh, it's great, I'm going out whaling for the weekend. So you didn't get up to any of that, did you, on the weekend,
Krish? No, I love Wales.
You love Wales, not whaling. Krish, great to have you with us. You were part of the debate yesterday about whether the resurrection really did happen or not. So if you have questions about the historicity of the resurrection, please chat to Krish afterwards. We've got a resource table up the back with great material on there. But Krish, today you're speaking to us about the big question of whether the resurrection upon which the Christian faith rises or falls, whether it really does matter and really does make any difference. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Hugh. Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Hey, you are there. It's great to see you. As you can probably tell from the way I look, I am Irish by background. My grandfather on my mother's side was from Ireland. My mother was born in India. My father was born in Malaysia, but my grandfather was born in Sri Lanka. So I'm kind of confused about where I'm from, but I'm just delighted to be here with you this afternoon. Now, I became a Christian because of three factors, and I want to explore them a little bit with you this afternoon and then give you a chance to answer, to ask some questions of me. And those three factors, one was the evidence of the resurrection. And yesterday we had a debate about whether that evidence stands up. And it's our conviction that the resurrection of Jesus really took place in history. If you'd have lived 2,000 years ago, you could have bumped into Jesus having died, stayed dead for 3 days, and then he was back to life again. And I became a Christian because I believe that really happened as a historical event. If the resurrection did not happen, I want to give up being a Christian today. So Christians believe in their faith because they believe it's actually historically true rather than just wish fulfillment or blind faith. So the first reason I became a Christian was because of the evidence. The second reason I became a Christian was because I saw a transformation in one of my friends' lives. Now, I went to a really, really rough state comprehensive school. My school was so rough that our room where we had registration or roll call was a chemistry lab. And in the mornings, the teacher used to nip out for a quick smoke, leaving 30 teenage boys in charge of a chemistry lab. Kids used to suck the gas out of the gas taps and try to light it on their breath with cigarette lighters. It was a really dangerous place to be a kid. I remember one morning, there was a guy called Nicky Leonard, and luckily he wasn't the brightest kid in the class because he had his cheeks full of gas. And I challenged Nicky, what would happen if you stuck a lighted match in your ear while your cheeks are full of gas? Now, I'm grateful that Nicky didn't actually try that experiment. He's still alive, I'm still alive, and I'm not in prison for kind of manslaughter. But in that environment, a 15-year-old boy stood up in front of the whole class and he said, guys, I've got to tell you something. Something amazing happened to me last night. I started a friendship with God and it's so good I want the rest of you to know about it. And that was the bravest thing I'd ever seen anyone do really actually live in front of me. And I went to challenge him about it. I said, look, why are you telling the whole class about this? And he said, look, if you knew the God I knew, then you would want the whole world to know about it. And I saw a shy boy become transformed, I believe, by the power of God, changing his life. And today he's working as a church leader. He's had a career in kind of the mental health services, using his gifts and his talents to help other people. I saw God change that boy's life, and I've seen it change many other people's lives. And maybe you know people here that are part of the EU, and you notice something different about them. I'd like to tell you that's because of the resurrected Jesus living with them, giving them the power to live a different life. Now, the third reason I became a Christian, if the first one was the evidence of the resurrection, the second reason was the transformation I saw in someone's life, the third reason is the explanatory power that the Christian faith gives you to understand life and everything in it. The famous Oxford literary scholar and author C.S. Lewis once said, I believe that the sun has risen in the morning, not just because I can see the sun, but because I can see everything else in its light. And I guess that's one way that I came to understand the Christian faith to be true. It's not just that the evidence of the resurrection stacks up. It's not just that you see people's lives changed, but it actually helps you understand what life is and what life is for. I just want to give you three areas that I think that the resurrection of Jesus helps us understand, and then we'll throw it open for some questions. The first area is the area of science. I became a chemist. I wasn't a very good chemist. I studied chemistry with medicinal chemistry at the University of Warwick in England. And I was useless as a chemist. I kind of broke most of the apparatus that we were given to look after within the first 2 weeks of arriving at university. I remember one of the experiments we were set was a kind of crystallization experiment, and we wouldn't be allowed home until we'd produced enough white crystals to be released from the lab. And so a friend of mine and I, we'd had a terrible day in the lab. We'd gone all completely wrong. And the only white crystals we could think of was getting our hair and kind of dusting it onto a piece of filtration paper and adding it to the product that we'd made. So we were not particularly good chemists, I must admit. But the interesting thing for me is that science is based on a faith premise, an assumption that the universe is ultimately understandable. That our minds are capable of grasping the way that the complexity of the universe has been put together. Now, if you look in the history of science in the modern era really started because of a group of people coming together, actually in England, called the Royal Society. And these men, and they were sadly mostly men, believed that the universe made sense because there was a rational mind that had put it together. What they believed was that you could think God's thoughts after him, that the universe had a creator, and therefore you would expect to find order, rationality, and beauty. Now, for me, that makes sense. You know, I'm not bad at using computers, and I can imagine creating a program that was capable of generating random letters to come up on the screen. And if I could generate that program and get the printouts from it, would it be worth reading those random letters that I generated? Would it be worth looking for some kind of pattern or sense behind them? Well, no, the whole point is that those letters have been generated randomly. Now, if the universe is actually just a random event, it has no purpose, it has no mind that ordered its creation, why do we expect there to be order and beauty in the complexity of the universe? But if I wrote you a letter, and I'm probably using the same letters that my random printout would be producing, if I wrote you a letter and an email, then you would expect to understand sense and meaning from the way that those letters have been put together, because a rational mind has put them together in the right order. And I guess that's the idea, that actually the resurrection of Jesus helps us to know that there is a God that created the universe, and he stepped into history and made his presence really visibly known by having a man die, stay dead for 3 days, and to come back to life again. And because of the resurrection, I expect the universe to have rationality behind it. And therefore, I'm going to enjoy the adventure of the sciences as I seek to think God's thoughts after him and explore the creation that he has made. So that's the first area of explanatory power. I think that the resurrection of Jesus gives us a reason why science is going to be worth doing, because there is a mind behind the universe. Now, the second area that I find that the resurrection of Jesus helps us with is the area of morality. Why do we expect things to be right or wrong? Why do we think that there is a moral framework that holds the universe together? Let me give you a thought experiment. Are any of you in your fourth year here? Any of you in your fourth year? Brilliant. And some of you might be writing a dissertation. Hands up if you're supposed to be writing a dissertation right now. Congratulations. Great. Good choice. Spend your time in the sun rather than writing it. Now, I want you to imagine that you have just completed your final year dissertation and you have worked so hard at it night and day. And it is a beautiful piece of work. Every word has been crafted perfectly. And amazingly, you've actually finished your dissertation 2 weeks early. And you go up to your tutor and you hand in this wonderful piece of work. And your tutor looks at you and he says, "I've never really liked you. I've always thought that one of your eyes was slightly higher than the other. And it's given me a crick in my neck every time I've looked at you. And so as a result of that, I'm going to fail your thesis. I'm not even going to read it. I just don't like you." Now, at that moment, what would you say? If you're a complete moral relativist, all you can say is, "Well, that's nice for you. I beg to disagree with you, but I agree. You're entitled to your opinion. I'm entitled to my opinion. Let's just leave it there," and you walk out. I'm guessing that most of us would say, "That is not fair." And when you do that, you're appealing to a moral standard that stands above you and your tutor. For some people, morality is based on a personal opinion. That's where you locate morality. It's whatever you decide for yourself. I've got my truth, you've got yours. Whatever you think is right for you, whatever you I think is right for me. But in that context, in the room with your tutor, I think that moral relativism goes out the window and you say that's not fair. So if morality isn't based on what you think or what I think, but it's based on another standard, where has that come from? Now, the second place that people try to locate morality is in the idea of a public consciousness or the majority rule. That morality is a social construct that we agree between each other. Well, let's just imagine this. So you come home from your tutor and you are angry. And so what do? You go for trial by Facebook. And you publish this terrible news that your tutor has failed you because one of your eyes is higher than the other, and you put it up on Facebook. And let's imagine that 100% of the students and faculty of Sydney University are actually on Facebook. That might not be hard to imagine, actually. And you ask for there to be a vote. You know, like this post if you agree with me that that is not fair. Now, the problem with Facebook is that your picture is actually on Facebook. And as you put this vote up, actually the majority of people on campus agree that one of your eyes is slightly higher than the other, and they've been really annoyed that you've given them a crick neck, and so they would like to say, actually, yes, we agree with the tutor because of your deformation in your face. We agree you should be failed. Now, if 51% or even 99% of the campus agreed with your tutor, would that make it right? If your gut instinct tells you no, even if the majority of people on campus disagreed with me, I was still right, I should still get a fair hearing, then you believe in something called absolute morality, something called a universal standard of good and bad. And you might say, well, okay, it's just this campus, they're socially conditioned. Let's go for the world. Let's imagine that 100% of this planet is on Facebook. But sadly, 51% of the world agrees that your face is slightly funny and you should be failed. Would that make it right? If your gut instinct tells you no, there is another higher moral standard that stands above individual human beings, stands above even societies, then where do you get that from? Where does that moral ethic come from? The Christian faith says, actually, we get our idea of right and wrong from a God, a transcendent God, who, even if the majority of the world thought something was right, still has the right to say no. There is a higher standard. There is an absolute moral framework. Now, the resurrection of Jesus tells us God exists, that he's made himself clearly visible to us, and actually that God has a moral standard. Because when Jesus died, the Bible says Jesus died for the sins of the world, and that by trusting in Jesus' death and his resurrection, no matter what you've done, no matter how you've fared morally in this world, there is an opportunity for forgiveness. And the resurrection tells us that God would not allow his innocent son to stay dead. Although he's died, taking on the sins of the world, the resurrection tells us that God says, I'm going to pick up Jesus. I accept his sacrifice, and I am now offering forgiveness to anyone who will take it. So if the first reason I think that the Christian gospel, that the resurrection of Jesus gives us explanatory power to understand the universe, was science, if the second reason was morality, the third and final reason before we open it up for questions is meaning. Now, there was an advertisement in the UK that was banned, and it was a pretty terrible advert, and it starts with a woman in labour, and not the Labour Party, she's actually having a baby. And she's grunting and groaning, and then she pushes really hard, and she pushes so hard that the fetus is ejected from her womb with some velocity, and it flies out of her uterus across the room and out the window. And it flies through the air, and it's streaming through the air like a jetliner. And it flies so fast, but as this fetus is flying through the air, it's suddenly growing older. And in a second, it's a toddler. In another second, it's an adolescent. In another second, it's an adult. In another second, it's a middle-aged man. In another second, it's an old man. And suddenly, the trajectory of this fetus, now old man, begins to curve down towards the earth. And it begins to home in towards the ground. And suddenly, it smashes into a grave. And then the screen goes black. And out pops the green words, life is short. Then some more words, play more. Then the final words, play Xbox. You can imagine why that advert might have been banned, but the idea behind it is classic existential philosophy. That there is ultimately no point to life. So what life is about is filling your moments of existence with as much fun and good experiences as you can before you die. Samuel Beckett, the playwright, said in Waiting for Godot, we give birth astride the grave. And that advert was trying to say, actually, you can make your life meaningful by playing more Xbox. And some of us are trying that experiment right now at this moment, aren't we? Trying to make life meaningful by playing Xbox. The problem is, no matter how many Worlds of Warcraft you play, you still feel there must be more than this. Someone else described life as like a blunt pencil. pointless. Someone else said, life is a sexually transmitted incurable disease. Finally, someone said, life is the journey between two hospitals, the one that you were born in and the one that you will die in. Now, some of us have faced the reality of death, not our own death, but maybe of a relative or a friend. And I can relate to that. My mother passed away earlier this year. And the finality of death is so powerful. I still have dreams trying to talk to my mum again. It's just a bizarre feeling that death robs you of a person that you've loved. What do we do about the fact that death seems to make life meaningless? What do we do about the fact that whether you are Mother Teresa or Hitler, you are still going to die? So what difference does it make for the life that you live now? I think there's something in us that says there must be more to life than death. And actually, the resurrection of Jesus is the answer to that. That your instinct that there is more to you than just this physical body is answered by the fact that one man did die, stayed dead for 3 days, and come back to life, not as a ghost or a hallucination, but as a physical human being, to give you hope that there is meaning to life and life is worth living. And in fact, if you come to understand that, if you come to accept that Jesus really did live and die and rise again, and you become a follower of him, it changes the way that you live your life. See, many people try to live life like it's a game of Monopoly. You know, the person that's got the most stuff at the end of the game wins. And because of that, we try to stuff as much stuff into our life as we can. But if you know that this life is important, but ultimately there is more to life than this life here, it allows you to be generous with your life. I've met so many Christians that have said, look, because I know that my future is secure, I want to give my life away. I want to spend my life not on what's good for me, but what's on good for others. I've met people that have given up powerful careers in order to help the poorest of the poor. People that have left the security of the Western world to go and invest their lives into the street children on the streets of Bolivia. People that have said, actually, I'm going to campaign for the rights of those that have been forgotten by society because I have my life secure. I want to give my life so that other people can have a chance at life. If you know that your future is secure, it gives you the freedom to be generous with your life towards other people. And that is the Christian call, actually, to trust Jesus with this life and to trust him into the life beyond and to live for him now in the way that he lived, a life of generosity and compassion for the sake of other people. Now, I've spoken a lot. I've given you some food for thought, hopefully. I would like to give you a chance for right of reply. And maybe just with someone sitting near you, and if you're over there, that's great. Come and join in the conversation. Maybe there's one question that you really want to raise about what I've said. Maybe it's an objection or a clarification question. Just for a few moments, why don't you discuss a question, and then my lovely assistant here will run to you a little bit later on with a microphone so you get a chance to ask your question. So just spend a couple of seconds formulating a question, and then we'll take them together. Hello? That's great. If you have to go to a lecture, that's fine. But if you've got a question, the lovely Yvette over here, give everyone a wave, Yvette, is happy to run to you with a mic so you get a chance to ask your question. You want to put your hand up if you've got a question that you want to raise today?
You're being intolerant in saying people are wrong.
Very helpful question. Do you think you're being intolerant saying people are wrong? Actually, that the next session we're going to do between... 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock is looking at the question of what about other faiths? And I really want to drill down into that. I don't want to give you a quick, glib answer to that question. I'd like to say briefly, no, I think truth is by its very nature exclusive, but not always so. So please stick around. I really want to answer that question in full in the next section, but thank you for asking it. Does anyone else want to raise a question? Stick your hand up. Yvette will come to you. If you ask nicely, she's a dancer, so she could dance towards you in an alluring way. Could you do that? Anyone else got a question they want to raise? Please feel free to raise it.
Does absolute morality have to come from God?
Does absolute morality have to come from God? That's a great question. I've not found a better system to locate it in. And I'm happy to have a chat with you afterwards if you've found one. A lot of people are trying to create one, and I don't know where you find it from. You know, we're having a nice long kind of extended dialogue with Richard Dawkins at the moment. And Dawkins is basically arguing evolution provides the framework by which we can understand everything that exists. I think it's really hard without God in the picture to create an ethic that actually values human life. Because if evolution is the sole reason, and I believe Christians can believe God uses evolution as a mechanism, but if evolution is all there is, then it's really hard, I think, to argue against survival of the fittest as a moral ethic, and you may even end up with a kind of Nazi approach of a super race or a master race. So, and I'm not saying, I hope I'm not saying this, that Christians are claiming to be better people than other people. I'm not saying that. But I think the moral ethic fits best, is most understandable with a picture with God in the equation. The famous Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, in his kind of epic work Brothers Karamazov, has his kind of one of his central characters, Ivan Karamazov, say, "If God does not exist, all things are permissible." And I think it's really hard, maybe not impossible, but really hard to find a moral ethic that makes sense if God does not exist. But I'm really happy to have that conversation with you a bit later. But thanks for raising it.
Well, thanks, Trish. We're going to be back for another hour looking at, we've looked at the good stuff of life and what Jesus has to say about that. We're going to be back with Murray looking at the ugly stuff in life and what the resurrection of Jesus has to say to that. And Chris will be speaking about the resurrection and other faiths. So please do stick around if you can from 1 till 2. The barbecue is going off like a frog in a sock. So go and grab 4, 5, 6 sausages. If you can't join us for the next hour, we'd love to see you tomorrow, 12 till 2 p.m. at the Eastern Avenue Auditorium to look at the question of whether God really wants to persuade us. Thanks again for joining us with This Is Life. Hope to see you for the next hour, which will kick off in about 10 minutes.